Hey, everyone, it's Matt here. Before you skip ahead, I wanted to remind you that if you like this podcast, you'll probably love Puck, where I write a newsletter twice a week called What I'm Hearing. It's got tons of inside analysis, tidbits about what's really going on in Hollywood. It's where I break news and I go deeper on the biggest topics, exclusive stuff that we don't get into on The Town. It's all part of Puck, which is like a digital magazine for plugged-in people. It's got about a dozen real insiders doing exclusive reporting in entertainment, media, sports, fashion, politics, and finance. If you're interested, listeners of The Town get a discount, actually. Just go to the description page of this episode, or you can go to puck.news/thetown to join Puck or start a free trial. Now, let's get on to the show. This episode of The Town is brought to you by FX's Feud, Capote versus the Swans. The second installment in Ryan Murphy's Feud anthology tells the story of acclaimed writer Truman Capote, once a confidant to society's most elite women, whom he nicknamed the Swans. Starring Naomi Watts, Diane Lane, Chloe Sevigny, Calista Flockhart, Demi Moore, Molly Ringwald, and Tom Hollander. For your Emmy consideration, visit fxnetworks.com/FYC. This episode is brought to you by Hulu. Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone star in Hulu's limited series Under the Bridge, a chilling true crime story based on the acclaimed novel. Hailed as a riveting and heartbreakingly realistic work by the Chicago Sun-Times, and featuring excellent performances, according to Time magazine, the series is for your Emmy consideration in all categories, including Outstanding Limited Series and Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Limited Series for Keough and Gladstone. For more information, visit fyc.hulu.com. It is Monday, May 6th. Monday morning quarterbacking is one of the oldest traditions in Hollywood. When a movie's a hit in theaters, everyone seems to have known it would work all along. And when it's not, the I told you so people are particularly loud. That's why a movie like The Fall Guy is interesting. The reactions today are all over the place. The domestic gross for this weekend was about $28 million. Pretty good for a rom-com these days. It's at $65 million worldwide. But The Fall Guy wasn't just a rom-com. It's also an action movie, and it was loosely connected to 40-year-old TV series, so there's IP involved, and it featured one of the hottest stars right now off of Barbie. And it costs more than $130 million to make after tax rebates. So it was given a full-scale summer movie marketing campaign, and we know those can cost up to about $100 million. Meaning Fall Guy ultimately has to get to about $300 million worldwide to make money. A tough one, but they tried. Ryan Gosling was everywhere. They screened the movie at South by Southwest and CinemaCon. And inside Universal, the expectation was that Fall Guy would play bigger, potentially start a new franchise. The director, David Leitch, he largely delivered. Reviews were in the 80s on Rotten Tomatoes, an A-minus cinema score. But the tracking predictions were in the low to mid-30s range, so it missed those. Which begs the question, what happened here? Does an early May movie need to have superheroes? Was the marketing campaign confusing? Did the press blitz peak too early? Was Gosling even a star in this context? Or was this movie kind of doomed to box office purgatory from the start? If that's true, it has much bigger implications for the summer movie universe. That's what we're going to discuss today with Lucas Shaw from Bloomberg. What the performance of The Fall Guy says about the state of theaters, and are movies like this an endangered species? From The Ringer and Puck, I'm Matt Bellany, and this is The Town. All right, we are here with Lucas Shaw from Bloomberg. Welcome back, Lucas.
Great to be here.
All right, we're talking about The Fall Guy and the bigger picture here. But before we get into what this all means and whether we've hit a bleak time in the movie business for these kinds of movies, can we agree, first of all, that this is a disappointment for Universal? Because I had seen so much commentary on this. Some people were like, what are you people talking about? This is a totally fine opening for this kind of movie, this type of time of year, this marketing campaign. What are you complaining about? $28 million is fine. And I say not fine.
It's not fine. We'll get into some of the reasons why, but a movie that is that expensive, $28 million is not fine. And also, you just talk to people at the studio. And when we were doing our box office draft earlier this year, and I talked to a couple people at Universal about it, like, they were all super high on this movie.
Totally.
And And it had hit the $30 million number in tracking. And I think they were all hoping, okay, positive buzz, good marketing campaign, like it'll get up to 35, 40, hell, maybe even 45 or 50. And it just stalled out. And it ends up coming in beneath sort of the modest expectations for the movie. And I think that this opening is really good for a romantic comedy or an action comedy if it had cost $60 million or something.
Right, right.
But when you have two movie stars that collectively commanded probably at least 30, if not $40 million, you got to earn that back opening weekend.
Yeah. So that gets to the why. And I want to get into why and whether it says anything broader about this moment. Because as much as this movie had going for it, very appealing stars, you know, Gosling arguably could not be hotter than he is right now. Pretty good marketing, pretty good publicity campaign. They were everywhere. There were things that were, I don't want to say up against it, but there were hurdles here. I mean, traditionally, movies about movies don't do well. The IP in this situation did not mean anything to anyone under 50.
Yeah, I did not realize that it was based on a movie until the end of...
Based on a TV show.
Yeah, until I saw the movie, and at the end, they brought the person out, and I was like, oh, right, this is based on a TV show.
Yeah, Lee Majors, he was a big star. But yes, I agree with you, and we'll get into that. Let's address it right now. I don't understand the calculus here, because... presumably Universal went bigger on this movie and said, okay, we can justify a spend in the 130, 150 range because not only do we have appealing stars in an action comedy, but this is IP. We can lean on the IP. But then the movie comes out, they don't lean on the IP. You would never know it in the marketing. And clearly the exit scores did not say that the IP was the reason people showed up. 50% of the people said Ryan Gosling was the reason they showed up. So why have it be IP in the first place? Or is that just the crutch that a studio uses to be able to take a swing like this?
I think it's a crutch because you'll have situations where they don't need to option the article or they don't need the book. They could just do it. And they option it anyways because it allows the studio executive to say, no, it was based on this thing that people really liked. I just think it's a safety mechanism.
But is it safety, though? That was the miscalculation.
No, it's total horseshit. It's total horseshit.
I mean, they thought it would be Mission Impossible. But Mission Impossible had entered the zeitgeist and had the catchy song, and you knew exactly what Mission Impossible was when you heard the name. It's an impossible mission. Fall Guy doesn't mean anything to anyone. It's just a name for a stunt. Why didn't they just call it The Stuntman?
Well, also, Mission Impossible had Tom Cruise, who was one of the biggest movie stars in the world. Ryan Gosling's popular, but he's not Tom Cruise in the 90s. And yeah, it's a very, if you actually drill down on the story, it's sort of a narrow story, right? It's a movie about a movie. It's a love story. Like, I enjoyed it quite a bit, but it feels like a movie that like could have come out in spring with half that budget. And like, if they'd done the same numbers, everyone would be talking about what a nice little, it should have been a double. The idea that this was ever going to be a home run was misguided, I think.
And it just feels like one of those TV adaptations from the 90s or 2000s, like Chips or Dukes of Hazzard, where that used to be enough. You know, you put Jessica Simpson and Daisy Dukes, and that was enough for Dukes of Hazzard to open 15, 20 years ago. It's just, that's not enough anymore.
No, but that movie, that's sort of the perfect example, okay? That movie opened to $30 million. So basically the same opening.
Dukes of Hazzard, you had that on the top of your head, or did you just look that up?
I just looked it up. It opened to $30 million, but it cost $50 million.
Yeah.
So that movie ends up grossing 111 worldwide and is considered probably a single, right? It's like did fine. If you consider marketing and all that, like that movie did fine.
Yeah.
If The Fall Guy opens to $111 million, someone's getting fired, right? Like that's a disaster. If it ultimately grosses $111 million, that's a disaster. Now it's going to do more than that, I think, because of overseas, but yeah.
Yeah, so the IP issue, baffling to me. I just don't think you can justify that kind of spend on IP that means nothing. Funnily enough, we're going to see another example later this summer at Universal with Twisters. And whether that IP means anything to anyone, I think they'll probably have better luck with Twisters just because, again, you know exactly what it is when you hear it. And the IP does mean something to an audience. It came out in the 90s, not the 80s. So they're probably going to have a better swing with that one. But IP just for IP's sake, like, it's got to actually mean something. So the other one here is the Gosling factor. And this may be a candidate for hottest take, but does Ryan Gosling mean anything to men? Look at his box office history. And if you look at the movies that have done well for him, his top grossers are Barbie, La La Land, Blade Runner 2049, which was aimed at men, then Crazy Stupid Love. Three of those four are for women, or primarily the audience is women. He's considered this A-list star because of Barbie right now, but I don't know that he's that big of a draw for men, or at least he hasn't proven it.
I also just don't know that he is a traditional movie star. I think he does really well in romantic comedies. He does really well in kind of Oscar-y movies. Barbie was the first like kind of summer blockbuster where he... Not the first, because he's done them before, but it was the most successful summer blockbuster he'd been in.
And man, they had to, Warner's had to twist his arm to do that movie. They had to open up the Brinks truck, pay him a shit ton of money, and convince him. This was like a weeks and months long campaign to get him to do Barbie. And he did it, and he made a fortune.
Yeah.
But my point is putting Ryan Gosling in an action rom-com, is he not a credible action star?
Well, it's honestly a little more of a rom-com than an action movie.
True, true. But it's got to be sold as an action movie to get the bigger audience.
Well, that I think was, again, one of the problems, right? Uh-huh. Was like they made a rom-com, but they made it with like 75 fight scenes. Yeah. And so it was like the most expensive rom-com you'll see. And that was sort of the problem, right?
Like it's like bolted on. They bolted on the action movie to the rom-com.
Yeah, you think about the rom-coms from last year and like, if you can make them for less than $70 million, you're in pretty good shape. I get why they sold it the way they do. And the director, David Leitch, he's way more of an action person than a romance person. But this movie was sort of stuck between two genres and it had the budget of one, but a lot of the appeal of the other. I think Ryan Gosling can be the lead in either an action movie or a romantic movie. He has that potential.
But like The Nice Guys with Russell Crowe, that didn't perform.
But if memory serves, was The Nice Guys was a Shane Black movie.
Yeah.
And also like a little bit, it was heavier. It was more story forward. It wasn't heavy action.
Yeah, true. Yeah. It was more of a thriller. Yeah. I know. It's just an interesting thing to think about because I consider Ryan Gosling to be one of our like A-list stars. And I don't know that the numbers back that up, especially considering what he is making to be in these movies. I don't know if the numbers back it up.
Yeah. I don't know. This movie felt like the type of project that appealed to people your age and my age, but like where they kind of wanted to reach people who are a generation younger. And that was another problem.
I think that's right, Lucas. I think Emily Blunt was not the right casting choice alongside Gosling. I don't think she was the right counterpoint for him. I think they needed to go
You want Zendaya.
No. I think they needed to go with like a younger... like more comedically focused, bigger star to go after like younger males and younger couples to go see this movie together. Like Jennifer Lawrence would be a perfect pick in my opinion.
So the demos on this movie were men over 25 were 38%. Women over 25 were 33%. And women over 25 gave the movie its highest grade. And then it goes to men under 25 was 16%. And women under 25 were at 13%. So younger women were the problem here.
Well, younger people in general were the problem.
Yeah, younger people in general,
like,
yes.
I think Blunt is great and a great actress, but she's not the right kind of draw. Like Gosling and Blunt as a couple that you're selling does not get 22-year-olds to go to the theater.
Yeah.
Even if they had great chemistry.
And starred in the number one and number two movies of last year. Starred is in quotes.
Yeah, but Barbie was Margot Robbie's movie.
Yeah. I don't know about that.
It was Margot Robbie's
movie. He added a lot.
He did, but it was ultimately Margot Robbie's movie.
But no one's Kitty Oppenheimer in a rom-com?
Yeah, Oppenheimer. Right. Emily Blunt, nobody is this. I don't think most people remember that she was in Oppenheimer.
I know.
Emily, look, I quite like Emily Blunt. I just don't think that she, like, if Ryan Gosling, it's like, yeah, he can probably open a movie, but it has to be the right movie. I don't think Emily Blunt can open a movie, period.
No. And it's funny because you look at the stats and it's all like Emily Blunt has all of these huge movies on her resume, but she's never the star of those movies.
She's great in them, but she's the kind of female romantic foil to a guy. Yeah.
Jungle Cruise or Edge of Tomorrow or, you know, all
Quiet
of those
Place.
Movies. Quiet Place. Yeah. she's actually in Quiet Place a lot, but I don't think they sold it on her. So, yeah, the demos on diversity, let's look at these for Fall Guy. It was a shocker. White people showed up for this one. 52% Caucasian for this movie, 25% Latino and Hispanic, 8% Black, 10% Asian, and 5% other. Yeah, this one heavily indexed for white people.
Maybe because it's an almost all white cast.
And based on a TV show that, you know, that starred a lot of white people. This episode is brought to you by Hulu. Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone star in Hulu's limited series Under the Bridge, a chilling true crime story based on the acclaimed novel. Hailed as a riveting and heartbreakingly realistic work by the Chicago Sun-Times and featuring excellent performances, according to Time magazine, the series is for your Emmy consideration in all categories, including Outstanding Limited Series and Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Limited Series for Keough and Gladstone. For more information, visit fyc.hulu.com.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
The foreign numbers here aren't especially great either. And that's a lot of the calculus, I think, with these movie stars, especially Gosling. Action comedies tend to perform okay or better than okay overseas, and they tend to have higher multiples. I've seen that, you know, typically you can expect 3.5 times the opening weekend for the ultimate of domestic gross. But this movie, I've seen the projections be 3.7, 3.8% just based on the reviews and the genre. So maybe it will do okay longer term, but I think it'll ultimately top out around 220, 250, which is interesting because that's exactly what Bullet Train did, David Leitch's last movie. And we were talking last week about how it probably would get to closer to 300, but I don't think that's happening now.
Does this impact how studios think about either of these actors? Does it impact how studios think about either of these genres? Like, what are the if you're Universal or if you're its rivals, what are the lessons you take from this?
So, yeah, let's get into that because I think there are a lot of lessons. First of all, IP cannot be for IP's sake. It's got to mean something. Secondly, I think that the budgets on these movies, it is no longer okay to think that a action movie with two appealing stars can hold its own in the summer. It just, it's gotta be made for less money and you gotta have lowered expectations. The Universal's gambit here was that they thought they could yada yada a summer movie based on a spring or fall template. And spending more and marketing it big shows that it just doesn't work. The audience has such high expectations for summer movies now. It's got to have an added element. And if you look at the movies in this genre that have worked, it's something like Ocean's 11, which has a huge A-list cast. It's something like Kingsman, which has, you know, the international espionage and the sort of bigger feeling than that. Or it's like a, you know, Men in Black type movie where it's an action comedy, but it's got superheroes and supernatural stuff in it. There's got to be an extra element. It can't just be action comedy at that budget.
Right. Well, I guess, can it open over the summer just with a smaller budget? Like if they spent $75 million on it,
Yeah, that's called The Expendables, and it's in August.
I don't know. Not that it's the same movie, but Sony released No Hard Feelings, which was a $70 million comedy last July.
Yeah, but that's a straight comedy. I mean, I don't know, but maybe so. I mean, Bullet Train is a good example. Bullet Train came out late in the summer, too, and had a big star in Brad Pitt.
No Hard Feelings cost $45 and made $87.
I don't think that $45 was real, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
But yes, fine. This would be more expensive than that, but it also is going to make a lot more than $87.
Yeah. Do you subscribe to the theory that this is a huge setback for the industry, that you cannot expect these kinds of movies to perform in that budget range? I mean, I don't think movies like this will get made anymore. I think if you're going to do an action-y comedy type movie, the budget ceiling has to be 80 or 90.
I keep coming back to the budget. I don't feel like there's any problem with making this movie. I don't feel like there's any problem with making movies around stars. I mean, look, there are things you could have done differently. Maybe you should have picked a little bit more of a lane between the romance and the action. Maybe you reconsider the exact casting choice. But again, I thought their chemistry was good. I just think this conversation is different if the movie costs $75 million. We don't care totally as much. And so the question is, the big question for the industry is, how do you get there? Because, for all the fuss around visual effects and action sequences and all of that, one of the big problems is that the two actors probably commanded a really significant portion of the budget. And I don't know how you bring that down. You're not going to get Ryan Gosling to, cut his quote by $10 million.
Glenn Powell is the poor man's Ryan Gosling.
That is the other argument would be that if you're going to make this movie with big, big stars,
yeah,
like Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, you lean into the romance, lean out of the action, and thus make it less expensive. And if you want to lean into the action, you pick lesser known but hot up-and-coming talent that doesn't command as much money.
You can say Sydney Sweeney. That's okay. Does this movie perform if it's
Sydney Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney? And Glenn Powell?
That should be a new category on the rewatch list, Craig. Does this movie gross an extra $50 to $100 million if it stars Sydney Sweeney and Glenn Powell?
I think the answer is probably always yes, right?
No, it doesn't.
Anyone
but you made less money than this opening weekend. It doesn't make, the answer is it doesn't open bigger, but it costs a heck of a lot less to produce. Yeah.
And you don't open it on the first Friday of May. That was the other issue, is they put this movie in a superhero release slot, and that because Deadpool moved because of the strike. So the expectations, I think, were higher simply because of the release date. And I honestly do think the audience expectations were a little higher because of that release date. Audiences are not dumb. They know when the summer kicks off, and the media around these movies tells them it's now summer movie season. So you're going to a big summer movie, and then they go to the Fall Guy, and it's like, fine. The action's fine. The romance is fine. It's not someone, driving a car into outer space or battling apes. Like, it's fine. So I think that was also a little bit of an issue here.
Well, what do you think the conversation is going to be next Monday after the new Planet of the Apes movies opens?
I think it'll do okay. I think the tracking for that one's in the mid-50s. I mean, unless it also underperforms, but those movies have been pretty consistent. It's also very well-known IP. Relevant to people. They know exactly what it is. There have been three recent movies that were all pretty good, and it'll deliver.
It's funny. We did an episode 2 years ago, the two of you did, about the release of the movie Emergency. I believe it's the Michael Bay movie. Or sorry, Ambulance.
Oh, Ambulance.
Ambulance.
I really liked that movie.
And we discussed, is this the death of the original action movie? And this conversation has now come back around 2 years later, except this movie has a major star in it. Do you think this is a huge setback for the original-ish or new-to-you action movie with a major star, that they can't do that? We need to go back to more dependable IP.
Well, Ambulance cost a lot less money and did not try to open the summer in early May.
And had no romance.
And it was like,
I mean, it had a little romance.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, that's a different play. That is more of a genre play. This is trying to be all audience and trying to lure women.
Well, and we'll see what happens, for example, with Bad Boys 4.
Yeah, I know. Bad Boys 3 did pretty well.
And, really well.
And Scott Mendelson, at least, thought it was a great movie. I never saw it. Serious question, though. At what point are the theaters going to start to hit the panic button and recognize that this year is going to be a total disaster?
Well, I think it depends on the chain.
AMC, my buddy Adam Aaron. When does he start to really
sweat? He insists that they're doing fine, right?
No, he doesn't. He says they have enough cash to last until 2025, where he says they will be better.
Got it. I don't think there's going to be one title. I think it's just going to be a continued, like, the business is down. Apes will do fine, but it'll probably do a little less fine than the previous ones. Maybe not. You've been following those numbers a little better. Like, If will do fine, but we don't really have a big blockbuster this summer until maybe Inside Out in mid-June. And I've started to worry that Despicable Me is not going to be as big as the previous ones have been. And that'll be a blow for
them. Why do you worry about that? Because you're not seeing the Gentle Minion content on your TikTok?
I just don't feel the momentum. I think it depends a little bit on maybe how big Inside Out is. But I just have a feeling.
They're certainly succeeding in the coveted ads on the NBA team floor department. Because those are super annoying. The Despicable Me 4 ads that you
yeah, there are a lot of there are a lot of those.
Yeah, Disney's no better. I watched SportsCenter last night, and literally there was like this 20-second overlay of the Apes Jungle before you got to the SportsCenter set. And I was like, really, guys? Like, I get it. You want me to see the Apes movie?
I'm just impressed that you're one of the seven people who still watches SportsCenter.
I do. I turn it on when I'm working, whatever. All right. Well, you and I will be proven wrong when The Fall Guy becomes the sleeper hit of the summer. We'll have to do another pod talking about how we were all wrong.
They need to get Emily Blunt on TikTok like Sydney Sweeney, just reposting all the fans.
I mean, that is another element, though, that neither Gosling nor Blunt has social media. They are not Sydney Sweeney out there plugging her wares all the time.
They're also 44.
I know. But Gosling's face is significantly younger.
I would beg to differ.
All right. Well, we'll see. Thank you, Lucas.
Thanks, Matt.
All right. We are back with the call sheet. Craig, did you watch the Tom Brady roast on Netflix last night?
I was in and out. I was seeing a lot of clips. I mean, it was a 3-hour roast. It was quite long.
That is a long roast.
Yeah. You know, I really can't believe that these roasts still happen. I mean, they're pretty inappropriate, especially just like being on Netflix. It's kind of like the one part of society that's like untouched. It's like Curb Your Enthusiasm and roasts are okay.
It's been grandfathered in. There's this whole theory that comedy has, you know, been forced to change, and there's all these concerns about people online, except for things that existed beforehand, like South Park Curb Your Enthusiasm, and roasts are in that category.
Anybody can come on and kind of just say the most heinous stuff you've ever heard, and it doesn't affect their career. It just kind of lives on its own on that roast.
Well, I think a lot of people watched that last night, and judging by the buzz, my prediction is that the Tom Brady roast is going to chart on the Netflix most watched, only in the U.S. Nobody cares about Tom Brady overseas. But in the U.S., I think it's going to make the top 10 next week. And I actually think it's going to make the Nielsen top 10 of originals. If you look, the Chris Rock special a year ago, Chris Rock went to number 5 on the Netflix chart, and he got to number 9 on Nielsen.
Well, there was a big lead up to that. There was a big marketing gear up for that, because that was Netflix's first live thing ever, right?
Yes, that is true. And it was Chris Rock talking about Will Smith for the first time.
Right, right, right.
But I do think that people are getting more and more accustomed to watching live stuff on Netflix. And you don't have to watch it live. You can watch it the next day. I actually didn't watch it last night. I'm going to probably watch it tonight. But I think that, like, this whole comedy thing, the buzz they've gotten around doing all these comedy events this past week, the Netflix is a Joke Festival. You and I, we went to Mulaney on Saturday night, had a good time. And I think that enough people are aware of this, that they're going to check this out on Netflix, and it's going to chart.
It's funny that Netflix is kind of cornering this comedy market, right? When you think of comedy now, you kind of think of Netflix, particularly in the stand-up space.
That's by design. Ted Sarandos loves comedy, and he said this is an underserved market. Like, we can own this. And they just went in and bought it all up.
Well, what I was going to say was, it's kind of funny that while I do think about stand-up when I think of Netflix, can you name a really funny television show that Netflix has created, or a funny movie on Netflix?
Well, there's not a lot of comedies anywhere these days. How dare you, though? You weren't into The Ranch?
No, is that the Ashton Kutcher show?
That was the Ashton Kutcher show.
No.
That we're not allowed to talk about the fact that Danny Masterson was also on it, but yes.
I know that they bought the Shane Gillis comedy, Tires, and which is coming out soon, but it is just funny that for how much money Netflix is investing in stand-up live comedy, they're really not in television, or they are, and it's not working.
Yeah, or you just don't know about it. They just come and go.
Yeah.
Grace and Frankie, that went like 12 seasons on Netflix. No, I think it went like 7, but that was a hit. But yeah, it was a different, out of a different era. They have a Chuck Lorre show. They do some comedies.
Well, it's also just easier to do stand-up, right? It's bankable. You know it's going to work, and it's like a sporting event. You kind of tune in for 1 2-hour chunk, and then you're done.
I like it because I can put it on, and it's like 50 minutes, and I can do other stuff and kind of listen and watch while I'm watching on Netflix.
Yeah, there's no narrative you have to pay attention to.
That's what we're going towards on Netflix. Stuff that you can watch while doing other things. I wonder if they will delete on subsequent airings the Bob Kraft joke that Brady didn't like, the massage parlor joke that he went over to Jeff Ross and said,
Tom needs to relax. All right. That is fair game at a roast. The other stuff that was said was far worse.
Oh, exactly. And Bob Kraft was there and actually presented at the roast. So you're fair game if you're up on stage.
Yeah, that's easy, low hanging fruit. You got to deal with that.
Exactly. And I feel like SNL has done 100 Bob Kraft massage parlor jokes. So,
totally.
You know, he can deal with it. All right, that's the show for today. I want to thank my guest, Lucas Shaw. I want to thank producer Craig Horlbeck, our editor, Jesse Lopez, and I want to thank you. We will see you later this week.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.